Okay, what I'd like to do now then is open this up to a more general discussion where you can ask more or less what you like, but to the topic of the meeting today, of course. The intention is that this discussion session is going to, the audio is going to be recorded, and so that imposes a few more logistical constraints on us and a little bit more discipline, if we can bear that, please. So, for the people asking a question, if you could wait to be recognised and then wait further for one of the roving microphones to arrive at you, then the first things you will say, even if you've just spoken a few moments previously, will be your name, and if it's the first time you've spoken, your affiliation, please. And if you could indicate early on who it is you think might be answering your question, it would give the opportunity for the people who are going to answer to come to the front, and then they can stand anywhere along the front here. We're not being videoed, so we're not constrained to being beside the podium. We've got some extra microphones on the table here, so if you stand on the stage anywhere, you'll be heard. Okay, so with that discipline hopefully in place, I'll take any general questions, please. I was too scared now. Here we go.
Bob Chaplow, consultant and grandfather. I think one of the key points that has come out from particularly the last presentation is the importance of continuity of a core team that is able to manage and drive the programme forward, and that the importance of those differs very significantly from the ability to bring in experts on a part-time basis to deal with particular issues. I'd like comments perhaps from Andy as to how he feels that core team that will provide the continuity and the links to the safety case in particular will be managed within the framework of the contract and commercial strategy.
Right, thanks, Bob. I mean, it's something that I've already started thinking about with our chief executive, if that's his title, the head, Bruce McGurney, the head of RW&D, in terms of thinking about how what does the intelligent client part of RW&D look like with regard to site characterisation and that interaction with the safety case side of things in particular. And, you know, when you actually look at it and say the sort of skills that people might need to support the various parts of the discipline-based parts of the site descriptive model and how that feeds through, you suddenly find that there's, you know, it's about a third of a person here and a whole person there and one and a half people here. And I think although we can plan around it in terms of what we think that role is big enough and important enough that should be part of us and that should be part of our intelligent client role, whereas another role is a third of a person to do that bit or half a person, well, we think that could therefore maybe be part of a management consultant or a particular contract. The reality of it is that people aren't like that. They don't fit into those kind of descriptions as to, oh, right, okay, you need someone with this shape and size and what have you. So I recognise that although you can come up with a plan for how you're going to deal with that and the shape of people that are needed, the reality is, as Tim said, there's a relatively small number of these people available. And going back to something I said in the first presentation about, you know, when I started work on Sellafield, 1 year out of an MSc, and I started on site, and for the first 6 months I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I was there, I was being steered and what have you. Within a couple of years of being working on that site, because it was very intensive, focused on the particular aspects of it, and because, as I said before, young, enthusiastic, all the rest of it, I ended up adding value to that programme and becoming, whether I could call myself a technical integrator, I was certainly someone who was involved in a lot of meetings about taking what was happening at site, linking it into the assessment team, etc. I would hope that we can fairly rapidly develop the right people, younger people, more junior people, into those roles if we get them early enough. But I go back to this point, that they can't do it on their own. There's going to need to be some access to others. So in answer to your point about this idea of, you know, whether bits of, you know, people having dipping in and out of programmes is good enough to deliver that role, I don't think it is. But I think if you can get the right people, the right blend of junior people and the people who are heading towards the grandparent side of things, and you can get that blend and work it up, and as Tim said, get it developed early on enough so that you don't suddenly on the first day think, well, how the hell are we going to do this? But you've been thinking about it for years probably before. That, I think, is the approach. So we are starting to think about it, but it's not something, particularly as we haven't even got a site yet, it's not something that you can be too prescriptive about. Does that, I don't know if that addresses the point you're making.
Paul Hart, Environment Agency. Considering the sort of long-term future climate change and the impacts that could have on a repository, what considerations have been given to long-term future climate change? I'd be particularly interested also in the SKB's experience in Sweden.
Maybe Kai's thinking about the answer on the SKB side of things. Like I said, I mean, at the moment, very much the approach to future development, if you like, future evolution of the site, sits very much within the assessments team. So I'm not the right person to speak to on that. It may be that if Cherry's still here, she might have something to say on that. But it's more the case of, I would see that the site characterisation programme is very much looking at defining the current site description, maybe some of the history that might help in terms of predicting what might happen in response to those. But my understanding is that you know, the way that's treated is by a number of variant scenarios. So you have a base scenario, and then there are variant scenarios, which obviously take into account site characterisation data, but then extend it further. But that would very much lie within the sort of the, it would take the site descriptive model as the platform upon which it then undertakes its modelling. So,
I'm not a part of the assessment team, safety assessment team either. But of course, climate change is very important in Sweden. It has been over the years because we are considering 100,000 years, and of course there will be glaciations and all that. So quite a lot of work that's been going on in the safety assessment concerns really future climate change. And I think that in a month's time, the latest safety assessment, SR site, will be published. If you read that one, you'll see a lot about climate change and how that will possibly affect the repository.
Has the design at Forsmark been changed or defined or affected by climate change considerations? Or is it purely on the geological aspects? Primarily on the geological aspects.
Well, in the selection of the two sites, we went through it to see if there is any major differences that would make one site more suitable than the other one. Regarding climate change, didn't find that. So that wasn't the major difference between the two sites. The major difference between the two sites was really the amount of water conductive fractures that played a very significant role. But then of course, things like raised water level, sea levels have to be considered, all that kind of effects of water climate change has to be considered. But they had at both sites. And they just have to be considered, and so they're not possessed threat.
And also considering sort of effects on the in situ stresses. So if, for example, you have glaciation and there are hundreds of metres of ice loading the ground, then that obviously is going to contribute to the stress distributions. Was that sort of things taken into account as well?
Yes, there's been a lot of work on glaciations with stresses, with groundwater chemistry, and all kind of effects that we have, and with model and so on. And I think all that will be presented in that SR site safety case. Though. So I think you will have much better answers on all your questions reading that report in a month's time.
Any more comments from the floor on that subject?
Mickey Allen, exploration geologist. Just to follow on from the last point, if I understand correctly, the most dangerous radioactivity is the short life, half-life, not the long term. So climate change is irrelevant. Or am I wrong?
I don't know whether I'd... Yes and no. The hazards are different. There's a lot more short-lived radioactive waste. So when we've concentrated it all together and put it in a disposal facility, the immediate hazard is going to be short-lived stuff that you need to keep and will be dealt with actually by being contained almost certainly within the disposal, within the engineered barriers that I talked about earlier. So actually the engineered barriers are very important for short-lived radioactivity because they will contain the short-lived waste for long enough for it to decay away. And in terms of doses, you know, you can draw decay curves for the total inventory of a disposal facility. A lot of it decays away comparatively early, in hundreds of years, not the hundreds of thousands of years we're talking about for the long-lived stuff. You're then left with the long-lived stuff. It's a comparatively small proportion of the total inventory in terms of becquerels, but it's there for a long time, and it's still radioactive. Some of it is chemotoxic, so it's still dangerous. And you therefore, and because of the long time scales, you can't rely on engineered barriers. The geological barriers become more and more important. Now, in terms of, say, which is more dangerous, which is safe, the point is that a geological disposal facility has got to be demonstrated to meet the safety requirements over the full range of its lifetime, which in other words, until all the radioactivity has effectively decayed. But different barriers will be important at different phases in its evolution. So you can't, I'm not sure it's really a particularly helpful question to ask which is more dangerous. They are all dangerous, they all need to be managed, which is why we're putting them in a geological disposal facility. Different features of the disposal facility will help and be actually be more important than different types of waste. So I don't know if that helps or whether there's a sort of follow-on question that... The point is, and it's an important point, there are at least some wastes, the very long-lived wastes, for which it is important to get the right set of geological barriers because you cannot possibly justify containment within the engineered barriers. These radioactive materials will start to move away from where they were placed, and then the geological barriers that control the rate at which the radionuclides migrate, and hence the time scale for their isolation from the biosphere, are very important. And that's why it's important to get a right geological setting for a geological disposal facility.
Thank you.
Any questions related to that?
Gregory Lainsworth, University of Manchester. I guess following on from what was just asked then, and you identifying these different types of waste with different, very different problems associated with them, how much thought has been given to disposing of them in completely different environments and completely different facilities? Because it would seem odd to try and dispose of to cure two completely different problems with completely different timescales associated with them, and constrain yourself to pick one particular environment to do it when it may be better to put one set in one environment and one set in a different environment.
Yeah, and to some extent that's a choice that we've made in the UK to actually manage our radioactive waste in a different way from other countries. We've heard from Kai that they actually split and have a different disposal facility for short-lived intermediate-level waste, some of which is going to a near-surface disposal facility that's currently operating, as opposed to the spent fuel, which is where the long-lived wastes are. In the UK, we have decided, and it was partially what came out of the Corman work and then the government's white paper, that we will seek to find a single disposal facility that can deal with the full inventory of waste. Now, that may not be possible, and certainly if you're talking about all the new build waste that could arise from a programme at some stage, wherever we find a site for disposal facility, you will run out of capacity, so it can't be one facility forever. But the decision has been taken in the UK that we will seek to find a single disposal facility that will deal with the full inventory of waste. If we can't do that, then we will need to look for multiple facilities. And there are two reasons why we couldn't do that. One is a capacity issue, we just can't get everything in one place. And the other one is the issue that I think you were alluding to, because you're looking for different features, it may not be appropriate. But actually, if you can find a disposal facility that will deal with the long-lived waste, which need the geological barrier, I'm confident that you would then be able to engineer vaults within that that will deal with the comparatively short-lived waste. What you're actually doing, to some extent, is overdoing it for the short-lived waste, because they've got a geological barrier that perhaps they don't need. But if that's possible and it's giving you even more safety, then that seems a reasonable thing to do. And given, of course, that one of the other major constraints, or the other major constraint on finding a site, is the volunteerism and getting a community that's willing to host a facility, that is proving to be difficult, and will be difficult enough for one facility, let alone saying we'd rather have two or three around the country. So again, I think that is another important driver towards seeking, if we can, to have one disposal facility.
Do we have a related comment here? Microphone, please, and your name.
Linda Warren, Coram. We on Coram are really pleased to take the credit for all sorts of things that are going well. And Coram has been referred to several times today, and that's great. But I think even I would say it was pushing it a little bit much to say that Coram could take credit for the way that waste is categorised in this country. We were tasked with looking at higher active waste, and we had categorisations already in advance, so we didn't actually have in front of us an option that said you can change the categorisation. So I think a little bit careful there in saying that it's because Coram said it was all going in one, that therefore you can't look at other options. And indeed, we did consider some other options for some waste.
Yeah, thank you, Linda, for that clarification.
I've got a question waiting, which I think is going to change the subject slightly. So if we have any more comments on this subject, I'll take them. Okay. Sorry, microphone.
Peter Stiles, Keele University, and this may be broadening it rather more than you care to, but I also sit in a committee of the Royal Society which is just about to report on non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. Now, with most nuclear installations, there are two things to think about. The first is safety. In other words, will it do harm to people because of something of its own volition? And the second is safeguarding, which is, can someone else get that material and do harm with that material? Now, generally, we've not thought as much about that as we've thought about safety. But in actual fact, with 54 countries having expressed an interest in new nuclear build, it's become clear that they can't all have fuel fabrication, they can't all have potentially reprocessing, and they can't all potentially have waste disposal. And part, not making the report too much, but will address that internationalisation. And part of that will be combined facilities as perhaps a solution. Now, how do we build in safeguardability? Because that actually assumes some later monitoring, which is not quite in the spirit of our kind of lock and go thinking on our present facilities.
I think if we can possibly park the internationalisation aspect momentarily,
potentially a European facility.
But if we could pick up on the safeguarding.
We've certainly recognised within our designs and within the work that we're doing the need. Some of the material which is currently within the inventory is subject to safeguards, and therefore we will need to deal with the issue of safeguards, which is all about, as you said, preventing it falling into the wrong hands. And there are various ways of doing that, and we need to make sure we have the right combination of inaccessibility and making it inaccessible and monitoring it while it is accessible. And to some extent, there's a balance between the two, because if you actually backfill, you know, and make it more and more difficult, and there's an interesting debate you can have about the extent to which you mark a site and try and leave, you know, draw attention to it for the future post-closure. And you can have an interesting debate about whether it's better to have it highly visibly marked so that everyone knows it's there, or whether actually you say, well, either that's not going to work or it's not the right thing. I mean, it's better if nobody knows it's there, because they're not going to go in and look. But we've certainly recognised in our designs that some of the material will need to be safeguarded, or could, some of the potential material potentially needs to be safeguarded based on the current inventory. And we are working with Euratom and the UK government to make sure that our designs have the appropriate features, both during the operational phase and then post-closure, to meet those safeguard requirements, which are in the end, you know, if it's been disposed of, to make sure it is beyond access and therefore meets the non-proliferation requirements in that way.
Do you want to make a brief comment on something like a European joint facility?
Well, I mean, the position, I think, is quite clear that the UK is looking to develop a solution for UK wastes, so we're not interested in disposing of other people's waste, and the inventory that we're looking to dispose of is UK waste. In case there's anyone here from Scotland, I know that Scotland's got its own policy, which is near-site, near-surface disposal of Scottish waste, but you know, just putting that to one side. We're not talking for a UK disposal facility of dealing with waste from other countries. And at the moment, the disposal countries that are making significant progress with disposal facilities are all doing it to deal with their own wastes. You're quite right, there are some countries, and within Europe it has been recognised that there are some countries that have nuclear waste that have comparatively small volumes, and it may well not be, either economic or for other reasons, the right thing to do for them each to have their own disposal facility. The European Commission has just published as a draft and is about to adopt a directive on nuclear waste, which actually effectively says that all member states need to have plans in place to deal with their nuclear waste without being prescriptive about what those plans are. We're clear that the UK plans are going to be geological disposal for those wastes that need it, of our waste. It will be interesting to see how, whether other countries do come together, and there's nothing to stop them doing it, and say we will seek a common solution. I think it makes the whole issue of siting, assuming that they're going to adopt a voluntarist approach, which after all is the only approach that's been demonstrated to work, how they're going to make that work when it could be between different countries. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think it is something that may happen, but it's not something that's high on the agenda at the moment.
Franz Bergen from the NII. I'm just adding to what Alan said, really. I fully agree with what Alan said. The UK's got no plans at the moment to deal with anybody else's waste. But one of the things that's often forgotten is not all radioactive waste comes from nuclear power. There's a lot of medical radioactive waste, and the small countries, particularly small African countries, for example, have not a lot of money, who are not going to be able to develop their own disposal facilities. So there is talk within IAEA about how that's best resolved. But at the moment, the UK policy is very clear.
Richard Shaw, BGS. Just to add to that, there is actually a European-funded project at the moment looking at, I think, what they call a regional repository for countries that have small quantities of waste, not necessarily arising from nuclear power, and looking at options for some form of a collaborative project. I think it's being led by the Dutch, but and the Irish are involved. But apart from that, I know little about it.
Following on from what Richard just said.
Sorry, the microphone and your name, please.
It's Tim McEwen again.
It's called the SAPIR programme. It's managed by Arius. If you go to the Arius website, A-R-I-U-S, they are basically very keen on regional repositories, or they used to be very keen on international repositories, but that seems to have somewhat died a death. But there's a lot of work done in this area, and it could well be that sometime in the next 5, 10, 15 years, these things will become real, particularly in parts of Eastern Europe, where some countries, for example, Slovenia, has half a reactor with Croatia. So it's completely absurd that Slovenia has its own high-level waste repository, for example. So the SAPIA program's had two parts. The first part's finished. I'm not sure the second part's finished yet. So if you want to know more about the subject, go to these various websites. You can read all about it and download the reports.
Thank you very much. One of the questions which Andy raised was one of managing health and safety as part of the site characterisation and construction process. I'd imagine, given the range of people here, there's a similar range of experiences of good and bad practice. I wonder if there's questions or comments that could come from the floor regarding that. Please.
My question is sort of around...
Your name, please.
I'm John Black from Inside Hydro. And I'm afraid... I've got a statement or two to make before I ask a couple of questions. The first is that this is not a scientific meeting. It was noticeable that that Andy and Paul, they described the RWMD's broad objectives and their commercial policy, and Paul went on to describe the techniques, jumping wonderfully over the idea of uncertainty and science. To my knowledge, this is the second or possibly the third meeting with this general style of project management. I would remind the officers of the Geological Society that this is the Geological Society. It's a scientific body. It's not the Institute of Project Management, and it's not the Institute of Health and Safety either. And I have the broad feeling that by holding meetings like this, I'm not sure whether or not the scientific society is endorsing this sort of meeting. My first question is then, is the society not a bit concerned that we are endorsing meetings that are non-scientific? And my second question is to the NDA, which is essentially, do you think you're engaging stakeholders by holding meetings like this?
I'll make a brief comment on your first question. The society serves science and profession. But I think your point is well made. If there's been too much focus on the profession side from these NDA meetings, then I think that's something which could possibly be addressed in future meetings. But I'll let the NDA answer the second question.
Well, I'll try to. I think the problem we have is that there's the range of people in this room. And the point was made to me right at the beginning when I was here looking at... trying to get the sound right for the animation, and somebody said, why are you doing an animation? What's the animation on? I explained. Well, why are you doing that? It's because actually there's a number of people in the audience who are geoscientific but haven't had a background in this particular area. We want to make sure that they can be involved in the program going forward, partly for exactly the reason that there aren't enough people out there. They're going to be turning into grandparents, etc. We need to be getting a wider involvement of geoscientists. But I think, in answer to your question, John, the proof is in the proof of the pudding's in the eating. If I get a lot of engagement back from this in terms of people providing views on both the technical aspects, the professional aspects, health and safety, etc., I would be very pleased with that. I totally take your point, which I think you just addressed there. Maybe we got the balance slightly wrong, and if we have, then obviously apologies go out to that. But it is quite hard to get to make sure that we are actually communicating with everybody in the room. We've tried to do it at a point where we can actually raise the understanding of the issues with people who aren't involved, but at the same time give the opportunity for individuals such as yourself who've been involved in it for many years and understand the technical issues far more than I could hope to, that you can be involved as well. I don't know if that answers it. But...
It's a relatively simple. I think we've had at least two of these meetings have been raising the issues. I think it's about time we got round to discussing the issues.
Well, I think I may be wrong, because bear in mind that I only joined the organisation less than 2 years ago. I think the one immediately before I joined was a much more focused on actual techniques. It was focused on improvements in technical site investigation techniques, etc. So that one, I would say, was. Unfortunately, I can't take credit for that because I wasn't actually here at the time. But I take your point, and maybe we should think about the next one being much more focused on the technical geoscientific aspects of it. So, yeah, that's feedback heard. We will consider it. Thank you.
I'm Bruce Yardley, and I had the dubious honour to be the science secretary at the time we started organising these meetings, so I should probably chip in something here. I actually have some sympathy with what you're saying, I must say immediately. On the other hand, it is very true that sometimes scientists are so focused on just discussing the science that we don't actually communicate with people who might want to apply that science, and there's a very clear need to get a balance. And unfortunately, if, for example, our local councils don't even know that geologists exist and that they're being asked to chip in and volunteer for a rad waste site, then I don't see anything wrong at all in a geological society organising a meeting at which local councillors can be invited to come along and listen to what earth scientists say. And at least many of us in the audience have absolutely no stake in this at all. And so we're not trying to sell anybody anything, and that makes us, again, a very good place to have these sorts of meetings. So I think that it's quite right and proper for the Geological Society, which, after all, is able to have charitable status, which is given to us by the taxpayer, to be doing things like this that are showing that we take on board the interests of wider society. But having said that, I don't like sitting listening to management talks all day either. And so I'd like to go on, if I may, and ask a question of whoever's appropriate from the NDA. And so we've heard about your strategy for dealing with, on the face of it, one site. Now, I've understood that effectively you only have a site from West Cumbria, and although you've made it absolutely as clear as you could, short of actually drawing your diagrams so that they didn't look exactly like Cumbria, to tell us that you're not thinking about disposing in Cumbria, what happens if a council in Lincolnshire or Norfolk or some other part of the world with totally different but perhaps equally or more suitable geology also volunteers? You haven't given us any idea how you're going to weigh up scientifically the difference. It's not a case of, well, there's a few more fractures in the Borrowdales here and a few less over there. It's going to be a matter of getting a bunch of people who are experts on hydrogeology of clay and weighing them up against people who are experts on hydrogeology of the Borrowdales. And have you got a strategy in place for dealing with that? And if not, when will you?
Okay. That's a very valid question. I can answer that one much more easily than other questions. Right. If other communities around the UK put their areas forward for consideration, the first step in the process will be essentially exactly the same as what is currently happening in West Cumbria. This is my understanding. It may well be that how the policy is applied is picked here. My understanding would be that, and the thing I can't get my head around, and it's something that is an issue, is what if they step forward in 3 years' time when things have moved up? But let's assume that they do so over a similar timescale. Then the process will get to a point where each of those communities agree identify a series of potential candidate sites. They then go into the desk-based studies phase, and the point you're making is, at that point, they need to be compared. There was a paper produced by that went out with the white paper, which presented a first stab at the methodology. It was put out for consultation because of other things and the fact it was so dark that online there hasn't been any feedback on it. But it presented an approach where it took the six high-level criteria that are presented in the white paper and then turn those essentially into objectives that could be used in a process and proposed an MCDA-type approach to those six high-level objectives to compare all candidate sites that went into that process. And we at RWMD are currently considering how would we support that process in terms of providing the information that that MCDA process could be applied to. It's a piece of internal work that we're undertaking, purely for us to get our heads around how could we do that. That process, and also the bit before it, which is probably slightly more complicated, which is if an area steps forward, and let's say for argument's sake, the whole of the area was, after BGS had looked at it, was suitable, to actually home in down to areas which are sufficient to be considered as potential candidate sites, there's, if you like, an identification of potential candidate sites process. And that we've also produced a note on that, which has been around various stakeholders, and as I understand it, is going to be going out, that both of those papers will be going out in some form of consultation later this year to look at that process and understand it, which is why we haven't talked about it here now, because... But yes, there will be, and then going back to the whole uncertainty side of things, you know, for certain sites, and it's not just necessarily a certain site in West Cumbria which you may be referring to, but other sites around the country, there may be huge differences in the information that's available to allow those comparisons. And that is one of the challenges that needs to be thought about, and we are thinking about how could you deal with that and the uncertainty. So we're not just sitting there saying, oh, we just, don't worry, it's fine, it's only going to be this one, but that's not what we're doing at all. We are coming up with a process which is applicable at a national level. And believe me, I would love there to be a lot of different sites that go into it, but we have no control over that. It'd be much more interesting and exciting to have, you know, an evaporite and a clay and a this and a that. We will have what we are given by the communities through that process, and it's as simple as that. Hopefully that answers the question.
Becky, I actually just wanted to respond to that question partly as well. I just wanted to underline, I don't want people to leave the room thinking that Cumbria only contains the Borrowdale volcanics. And no, I'm not joking in all of this, because there's some kind of feel of it's a done deal about what was said there. And it's not. And it can't be either. This needs to be a process that looks at all of the volumes of rocks and considers them all on their merits. And this is not about going back to the old site. It may or it may not end up one of the candidate sites.
Paul Hart, Environment Agency. I'm just following on from that point. How are local authorities, how are they sort of being kept up to date with developments and... who in the local authority would actually sort of put their hand up and say, yes, I'm going to take this forward for the community and express an interest? I mean, you know, how in effect are you advertising what is a possibility for several local authorities possibly?
Probably that's best answered by Declan.
If I pick that up, given that's part of the process the government is leading.
There have been a number of things that we've done over the last 2.5 years to promote the invitation that was made to local authorities at the time the white paper was published. There have been a number of letters to senior officers of all of the local authorities in England sent by DEC ministers. And there have been also a number of events that DEC officials have attended to promote that invitation and provide more information to local communities who want more information in an informal setting without making any formal expression of interest. And we've used a number of newsletters, publications, etc. to promote that message as well. If anyone else has any further ideas or avenues by which we can get that message to the right people in local authorities across the country, we're more than happy to do that. And we remain more than happy to talk to local authorities now. And we are keen to often make sure that in speeches and various other things that our ministers give, they make reference to the fact that invitation is still open. Hope that answers the question.
David Bennett, Terrace Alice Limited. Just to follow up on the last question, timing is everything in almost all spheres. And we're just going through a very difficult public spending round, and it may be a good time to reinvigorate the invitations possibly to some of the local authorities. That's one thought. The question that comes with that is how long will that process of inviting invitations potentially last? I'm not looking for a particular date, yeah. obviously, but you know, it's open now. Will it be open in 10 years, or I don't know?
Well, it's open now, and it will remain open for the foreseeable future. If you look around the world at different approaches, there are scenarios where communities have come forward at different times, and they've been dealt with in different ways. Clearly, we wouldn't be keen to hold up progress on communities that came forward early on in the process. Communities come in many years down the road, but there are a number of ways in which that could be dealt with. And so the invitation remains open. It's going to remain open for the foreseeable future. And we'll have to look at that in a case-by-case basis if communities come forward a long way down the track in terms of what the best way of continuing to engage with those without delaying progress is. But we are still a small number of years into a very long programme, and there is a lot of time to address those sorts of issues.
Thank you very much. Time for a few more questions. I'm particularly keen on ones maybe that address the quality assurance side of things, but we have a question.
David Braun, Coram. I've heard about boreholes today, but I've not heard any mention of underground laboratories or ongoing facilities that monitor alongside the facilities.
No, you haven't, David, and that's because I think the focus has been on the earlier stages of the MRWS process up until we've actually got a site identified and we're actually into stage six, which the white paper refers to as underground operations. We've recognised and are recognising in our plans that the early stages of those underground operations, when you actually get people underground, will be to do further confirmatory, exploratory research, whatever label you want to put on it work, to confirm the results of the surface-based investigations and to confirm that the site is suitable at that first stage of construction, because clearly it would be daft to do, you know, huge amounts of work excavating tunnels and vaults until you'd confirm the results from the surface-based investigations. As the construction proceeds, and it's a phased construction throughout the life of the facility, not sort of build it all and then put the waste in, effectively there'll be continued opening up of additional volumes of rock, and they will need to be characterised to confirm that they are suitable. And there will also have to be a programme of monitoring during stage six to make sure that the site is as expected and is, during construction, evolving as expected.
So you're saying there isn't really a stage 5A where you've got your surface investigations, then you've got some sort of smaller research facility, and then you've got your construction. You're saying there isn't a 5A in your mind?
We don't, at the moment, necessarily see that there's a need to have a 5, a 5A and a 6. We recognise the need in our plans to do scientific and confirmatory work underground once we get there. We're planning on the basis that that can be done in parallel with the early stages of construction. Now, it may well be, depending on the site and depending on the degree of uncertainty in Andy's triangle, if you end up with actually still quite a large element of uncertainty at the end of surface-based investigation, because that's when you've decided to end the surface-based investigation phase, the decision may... I mean, one possible decision, to take one scenario, is that the people managing this project at the time, I doubt if it will be me, I'll be in the grandfather stage by then, may well decide that the right thing to do is actually to stop the surface-based investigation phase, because we don't want to drill any more boreholes and risk damaging the site or whatever. Let's get underground and let's do the remainder of the site characterisation from underground. And we might then want to call that a rock characterisation phase. It may be that if the surface-based investigation is going well, I think Becky had it exactly right, you need to be modelling and developing models that capture the understanding of the site and then testing that against fresh data, you may get to the point where you're confident you're quite close to the tip of that triangle, and then the plan would be, well, let's get underground. There's bound to be some residual uncertainties. Deal with those in some sort of underground laboratory while construction proceeds. What I'm keen to do is that we don't actually constrain the people who will make those decisions at the time by saying now there will be a 5, there will be a 5A or say and then a 6, but to recognise that we need to keep options open for the people making the decisions at the time so that the right things are done at the time.
Thank you. I've got time for one final question, please, here.
John Arthur, Top Site Studies, and of course I was involved with Dounreay and Sellafield. Alan, you made the implication that NDA are not really concerned with researching different rock qualities. Now, my understanding was in the early stages that Nirex actually played quite a part in the rock laboratories which were being excavated in other countries. And so we have the Belgian one in Soft and the Crimsal one in Switzerland and Hard, and I don't know whether there's any evaporite site being looked at, but can you tell us whether NDA are in fact continuing the liaison with those organisations who have actually got rock laboratories and benefiting from those?
Yes, we are. We have bilateral agreements with, I think, nearly every, probably every waste management organisation that is developing geological disposal in the world. We collaborate with them on joint programmes. We collaborate with a lot of European programmes, and certainly those organisations that have a rock characterisation laboratory, and there is actually a big, you mentioned evaporites, information that WIP gained. I don't think they had an rock characterisation facility stage, but they certainly gained information once they got underground. And we work with DOE and the contractors managing WIP, as we do with SKB and the ESBO facility and Bure in France, which I've been to, and a number of our staff have been to make sure that we are learning from those experiences and picking up, you know, and learning from what other people have learnt from underground facilities, as well as, you know, as we've learnt today, what other organisations have learnt from site investigation programmes.
Very good. Our time now, I fear, has come to an end, although tea and coffee awaits and we can continue our discussions there. Just falls to me then to close the meeting. It's clear from the picture painted today that there's a number of challenges. Volunteerism itself is a challenge. Getting the right number of suitably qualified people, these technical integrators, but also armies of other experts and practitioners, is going to be a challenge. There's a challenge to NDA in conceiving something that at this stage is both detailed but also sufficiently generic, that it is sufficiently flexible, that it's going to be able to react to what is an unknown set of challenges, certainly in terms of the geology, because, although labouring the point, we don't know where it's going to be yet. But it's also clear there's a very strong willingness, I think, from the NDA to communicate. And of course, it's a truism that communication is what the listener does. So there's been an amount of transmitting, and there's been some excellent feedback, particularly in the last sort of two sessions, in terms of what's come from the floor here. But for that communication to continue, if NDA are listening, then we need to be talking at them. And so I would finish by encouraging everyone to continue these conversations, not only in coffee afterwards, but through the various communication routes which have been set up through websites and email addresses and what have you, which you've seen on the screens today. So thank you again to all our speakers today, and thank you to you guys for your participation. Thank you very much.